to act soon. Entries must be postmarked by tomorrow to win the high-definition TV, the computer, or the TechLine furniture. Fill out the form and send it in today.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. The 2004-2005 season opens this month with performances by singer Emmylou Harris, family entertainer Dan Zanes, the Baryshnikov Dance Foundation's Forbidden Christmas, and jazz masters Nancy Wilson and Ramsey Lewis. Visit KrannertCenter.com for information on the entire season.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Travis Stansel. Once again, in this hour of the show, we're offering a Focus 580 archive interview. That means that in this part of the program, we will not be taking your calls. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be doing a little bit of military history, and we'll be talking about a device that is, I think, arguably the most sophisticated war machine that exists today. And what we're talking about is the submarine. Now, you no doubt think of it as being a relatively modern device, at least when you think about submarines in warfare. You know, probably, most people will know that they first became important in war during World War I and played an important role, of course, in World War II, and then perhaps an even more significant role in the Cold War when we get into the era of the nuclear-powered submarine that is truly capable of staying underwater for a very long period of time and, of course, firing missiles without surfacing. While all of that is true, the submarine has a much longer history than that. And in fact, the very first use of a submarine in warfare was during the American Revolution. And it was a craft that carried one man, and it was called the Turtle. And we'll talk about that and a number of other things this morning as we talk with Thomas Parrish, who is author of a recently published book titled The Submarine, A History, and is published by Viking. Thomas Parrish has written a number of books on 20th century history, including Berlin in the Balance, The Cold War Encyclopedia, The American Codebreakers, and Roosevelt and Marshall. He also created and edited the Simon & Schuster Encyclopedia of World War II and the six-volume series Men and Battle. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Parrish, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Two big major points that emerge from the book that I think are interesting and worth mentioning before we get into some of the detailed history. One is that it seems to be the case that all along in the development of the submarine, the forces driving it, it seems that it was almost never governments and maybe not even the big militaries. It seems that always it was the work of individuals, whether we're talking about entrepreneurs or inventors or perhaps the people who sailed the boats and lived in them, that's where the impetus for developing this technology seems always to have come from.
Well, if you're looking well back in history, of course, that would be generally true, as it might be with a number of other things, but it was such an unorthodox vessel that even when it was developed, people had really very little idea what to do with it. And I suppose, in reference to your particular point here, in the late 19th century, one particular inventor, John Holland, was much concerned, and we call him essentially the father of the submarine. He was attempting desperately to interest the United States government in the submarine. So in that sense, your point is certainly right. And he negotiated endlessly, as many people who've dealt with governments know how they do. But he did end up finally selling the government what became the really first regular commissioned submarine in any Navy, and that was in 1900. And I really date the modern submarine from that era, and it was called, as we look back on it now, SS-1. It was the USS Holland. Of course, back in history, you had people like Leonardo da Vinci, who drew sketches, refused to reveal his secret, as he claimed he had, to anybody, and on through the years. And these were people, sort of Edisons in their day, in a way, or to some extent Benjamin Franklins in their day, and Robert Fulton was perhaps the best known of them, working around the turn of the century. In the Napoleonic era, he attempted to sell submarine to the French, mm-hmm. and so forth. But he had greater success, as you know, on top of the water rather than under the water. So mm-hmm. it was indeed a field that attracted many entrepreneurs and took governments a long time to become interested in. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that seems to be a constant theme, something that's always been a part of being involved with these craft, is the very high level of danger. And the fact that I think it's also true is that the people who have been in the submarine service, no matter where you're talking about, it's always been volunteers. And it's been obviously people who've been attracted to it, perhaps in some part because of the danger.
Well, I would say mostly volunteers. In World War II, there are instances in various navies in which people were simply assigned to them. Oh. And even nowadays, if you're a nuclear technician, as one told me, when you graduate from school, you don't really know whether you're going to be assigned to a surface vessel or a submarine. So you're prepared for either one, and that depends upon how the personnel office wishes to treat you. So in that case, but in general, the idea of volunteer service is right, just the idea of special camaraderie and the idea of almost special personality types sometimes seems to be involved. As a matter of fact, in a discussion with a group of submarine veterans recently, I asked them whether we could consider the idea that there might be two types of persons, the submarine type and everybody else, because these fellows never seem to think of claustrophobia, and everybody else mentions that as the first thing.
Yeah. And I think that it's also true, and maybe it's been more true in the era of the Cold War, that so much of what the submarine service does is secret.
Yes.
So that means that they probably could only talk about it with each other.
Well, of course, and it was always known as the silent service, you know. Mm. It was invisible. You didn't have submarines in action the way you see even paintings of naval battles, you know, and so forth. Mm. So that it's true, it was inconspicuous and also relatively small. Handfuls of people compared with the size not only of armies but of countries' navies overall.
Just to look at some of the interesting examples before the era of what you would call the true modern submarine, or mm-hmm. that happens only in 1900.
Yeah.
I'm just interested in having you talk a little bit about some of these earlier devices, and the one I'm thinking about particularly is the Turtle, just because it's an interesting
yes.
sort of sidelight, and it was a one man craft. It was powered by foot pedals. It sounds like it was almost kind of like riding a bicycle, that the guy inside had to pedal it. And that there was an attempt to use it to sink a ship, but I guess it wasn't successful.
Well, it is thought, yeah, this is an incredible assignment. The thing was shaped essentially like a blob, as far as we know. And this was an attempt to sink a British man of war in New York Harbor in 1776. And it was indeed a one-man vessel, probably worked by foot pedals, although some people have said maybe a hand crank. We don't really have an actual model of it, but we have ideas about it. And the person had to go out into a murky harbor, keep the propeller turning, aim it where he wanted to go. And of course, you weren't doing this in daylight. You were doing when it was reasonably dark, so he wouldn't be spotted. And you're going along through the bay trying to do all these things. Then he had to arrive at this British man of war, which happened to be HMS Eagle. And the idea was that he would screw into the keel something essentially that would hold a time bomb, is really what it amounts to. A bomb that he could release actually from a little distance would be a better way to put it. And then, having screwed this into the keel, he was supposed to make his getaway. Well, this in fact did not work. It's incredible that anybody would even get close to his target. And probably there were some think that the ventilation, of course, was practically non-existent, and even though he was sort of awash and probably not completely under the surface, but even so, the ventilation was so bad that he may well have been rendered not altogether compost by carbon dioxide as he was doing this, and maybe never really even got there. Some think he got there and couldn't get it screwed in. We don't know for sure, but it was the first real attempt that I can tell you like that on an enemy man of war.
Mm-hmm.
But amazing. I mean, but today, you know, you could have contests to see who could do it because it was almost an impossible feat.
The as you mentioned, there were some other people who were doing some work along these lines. There was Robert Fulton who attempted to interest the British and the French and the United States in funding his work to develop a submarine.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't really until the Civil War that there were really serious and I guess you'd have to say successful efforts to develop these kind of craft. And I think that it was during the Civil War that the first ship was actually sunk by a submarine in war?
Yes, that was the sinking off Charleston by the Hunley, the one that was raised to great acclaim in the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
This was a Confederate vessel, an attempt by the Confederates to break the Union blockade on the South, and particularly onerous in Charleston. And it did sink a northern ship. Interestingly enough, the water wasn't very deep, so that people, the sailors, managed to climb up into the rigging and mostly escape. Then the Hunley, having sunk its weapon into the northern ship, backed away and disappeared. And that was the last scene of it. It went off into the mist. This was at night. And was next seen again in the year 2000. It was seen by divers, but I mean to say seen above the water. And actually, in its approach, it probably was a wash too, that is not completely submerged, but it was the first sinking of an enemy vessel by a submersible craft, let us put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's justly famous for that. But again, it had to be worked by human power, not one person in this case. There were several. And they were turning what apparently was a long crank, sort of like a brazen bit. And they were turning this to turn the propeller. So the thing that had always impeded the development of the submarine was the lack of any kind of really useful power source that could make it a menace, give it any kind of cruising range, and so forth.
Yeah. The Hunley was fitted with an explosive device that mm-hmm. they called a torpedo, although it was nothing like what we think of now when you think of the torpedo that was used in World War I and II. Basically, it was an explosive that they managed to get it up against the side of the mm-hmm. of the boat, the Housatonic. But it wasn't what we think of today as a torpedo.
No, torpedo was an old word used for bombs, you know. The most famous line, I guess, is "Damn the torpedoes" from Admiral Farragut.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't really mean vessels that would be out there shooting torpedoes at you. He meant mines in the Mobile Harbor. So torpedo was an early word, and then actually the first term for what we now call torpedoes was automobile torpedo, i.e., self-moving, self-powered torpedo. And then, of course, that modifier dropped away, and we just say torpedo, and that swept the field and became the standard meaning.
That's just, I suppose this is jumping ahead a little bit in the story, but that obviously that was an important development, and one of the things that you write about in the book is just how complicated a device that is to get it to work correctly, to manufacture it so that it will work reliably, that apparently designing and building a highly effective torpedo is not an easy thing.
No, in fact, it has a lot of delicate machinery in it and was almost in some ways a work of art. It was a product of the 19th century when there were, you know, much fine work done in brass and so forth. And the torpedo was really a marvel of engineering in many ways and was difficult to mass produce because it really was an object of craftsmanship in many ways. And torpedoes in all navies have always tended to cause problems of various kinds. And as soon as some problem would be ironed out, some other difficulty would arise. This affected the British and the Germans and the United States, the Japanese. Everybody has had trouble with them because they are delicate. Many things can go wrong. And I guess perhaps the most horrible of all is when your torpedo decides to turn on you and come back and torpedo the vessel launching it. But all kinds of problems they have, and certainly did in the First World, and then World War. And then in the Second War, the Germans and the Americans both had serious problems with torpedoes, which with the Americans went on through a good part of the war, well into 1943. So that and they were expensive too. Another thing to remember is that they cost a lot of money. Say what you could buy in those days, say two or three cars for what a torpedo would cost, and therefore they were very carefully husbanded. And when people went to war, 1941, that was the first time most of them had ever heard a torpedo explode. They didn't know whether they hit anything or not because they didn't even know what it would sound like.
Yeah, that was, I gather, was one of the difficulties that also because they were so expensive and you could not waste them.
Yes.
That it was the submariners really didn't get the opportunity to train under real war kinds of conditions because they didn't. They certainly didn't want them shooting off any torpedoes, just blowing up an old ship just for practice.
Exactly right. They did a test in the 20s, and that was essentially the test that lasted until World War II. Yes, it's so.
Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Thomas Parrish. He's written a number of books about American history and is the author of a book that's just out fairly recently now that's titled The Submarine, A History, published by Viking. And it's about the development of the submarine and its use in warfare. As you said, probably the major advancement that brings the submarine into the modern age is when we get into the fact where it is not human-powered. The earlier examples were things that people had to crank or had to propel, and there were some that were steam-powered, but probably the big advancement was indeed when Holland and also Simon Lake were both important figures in developing the submarine, and the big advancement was when you had a submarine that had engines, and that particular one, the one that Holland built and finally sold to the Navy in 1900, worked with both a gasoline-powered engine, and I guess that was when it was running on the surface. It had a gasoline engine, but actually when it was running underwater, it had an electric motor.
Yeah. They, of course, couldn't have air to run an internal combustion engine when you were underwater. So submarines then and always until the nuclear age were powered by these batteries underwater. And the World War II submarines, for example, are normally referred to as diesel-electric submarines because they're always the two sources of power. The great development, too, in that was in the first decade of the 20th century when the diesel engine was sufficiently perfected to replace the gasoline engine, which, of course, produced dangerous fumes, which were very volatile and were always a source of trouble, and the diesel engine would run on almost anything, and therefore was a great improvement, and that became standard and was until the 1950s and the advent of the nuclear age.
Mm-hmm. I think, almost any kid or people who have familiar with a little bit of the history of the wars and have seen war movies, knows what a submarine looks like. Hmm. You say, draw me a picture of a submarine. Well, anybody can do that and have the idea that indeed it's this long tube-like thing, basically, almost fish-shaped. So maybe that was the metaphor with this little tower on the top where the periscope is and that sort of thing. As things went along, was the idea that that's what a submarine should look like, was that always the idea?
Well, when you go back to Holland, the inventor we were talking about a minute ago, Holland was a remarkable dreamer as well as executor of plans, and he really, more clearly, I think, than anybody for some time, saw the submarine as an underwater vessel. So his ideal shape was something on the order of the dolphin, something of that kind. He was not much concerned with how it performed on the surface. Now, this did not please most people in the Navy, and it would ride with great difficulty, and as Holland acidly observed, it didn't give them a deck to strut around on if they had that sort of thing. So when the Navy bought these submarines and began working on them, they got together with the electric boat company, which was the chief builder or chief supplier of submarines for the Navy for a long time, and indeed still is. And they put on it a kind of superstructure. I think I likened it at one point to a yacht, so that you had a deck and everything else, and the submarines, such as you see in World War II movies, for example, look rather like conventional vessels in many ways, with this decking and so forth. Mm-hmm. Holland's idea was the thing just more of a teardrop aerodynamic, and later, and well, as a matter of fact, let me interrupt myself, when the Nautilus, the first nuclear sub, was created in the 1950s, it had a rather conventional design, too. What was revolutionary about it was its nuclear power plant, not its design. But then the Navy moved into more hydrodynamic shapes, harking back after more than a half century to the ideas of Holland. But so when we think of a submarine in World War II, we think of that more conventional thing. But if you look at submarines later, you see how the shape has evolved and changed. And now they have this thing on top they call a sail, you know, because you have to have some kind of central command post. Mm-hmm. But it does not anymore look like a small passenger boat.
True, the true submarine, I guess, if your test is how long can you stay underwater, that's the doesn't come until we have the nuclear powered submarines that we have today. I guess when you look back to the submarines of say World War I and World War II, mm-hmm. how much of their operating time did they spend essentially on the surface, and how much truly submerged?
Well, normally almost all on the surface, because they would go to their submarines operate in what they call patrol areas, generally speaking. They would have a assigned part of the ocean for most purposes. And in proceeding to that, unless they were in danger of being sighted by the enemy, they would, of course, run on the surface. Then getting close to that area or in an actual operation, they would submerge, but they could only run a few hours on the storage batteries normally. So then they would have to surface to recharge those batteries. And this was an extreme limitation on the operation of the submarine. Essentially, a submarine for all those years was a surface vessel that could sink at will and fortunately could also come back to the surface. A nuclear submarine is completely different. It is designed for the depths, rides best at depths, and goes fastest in the depths. So it can stay underwater until the pizza runs out and they have to go back to their home base.
Mm-hmm. The first important use of submarine in warfare was World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, Germany made a significant commitment to make that part of an important part of their Navy, an important part of their strategy. And in this, it's interesting, and I think you also note in the book, that over time, the significance of the submarine changes, and what really is important about it, how it's used, changes from one period to the next in World War I, World War II, and also the Cold War. And I wonder if you could talk about that, and particularly why, you know, the importance that the German government and Navy attached to the submarine in World War I.
All right. When the submarine was started, of course, and joined navies in the say the first decade or so of the 20th century, it was naturally thought of as a warship. The question was, what would they do with it? Nobody was quite sure. So the term fleet submarine began to be bandied about all through the early part of the 20th century, the idea being that this would be a submarine that would be a part of the fleet, and our World War II submarines were always called fleet submarines. This meant they hoped that they would operate in conjunction with battleships, cruisers, and the like. The problem was it just did not really work very well. Submarine was unable to keep up with such ships, and it never really panned out as a participant in operation. So they thought, well, maybe it can be an observation vessel. Maybe it can be this, maybe it can be that. But certainly they thought it would sink enemy warships. And at the opening of the First World War in 1914, this was the idea, essentially. But then one day in October 1914, a German submarine sank a very small British freighter. Actually, didn't even sink it with a torpedo or gunfire. The threat of these things was enough to make the poor captain surrender his little 866-ton boat. And opening the seacocks and send it to the bottom of the sea. Well, this was the first time that a commercial vessel had ever been sunk by a submarine. And gradually, the Germans began to realize that since they were being blockaded, a distant blockade by the British, this would be a way for them to fight back, to try to choke off British supplies by means of, as it's called, commerce raiding. So, actually, what I would discuss really in a good part about the First World War is the nature of this commerce raiding campaign, which was the central use of the submarine then. Battleships and so forth are all very spectacular, but sinking of a group of freighters and tankers, that was the real thing. The submarine as a commerce raider, more than the submarine directly as a warship. That was its role.
Yeah, it's interesting that I guess early on there might have been some controversy in military circles about the use of the submarine because it does not announce its presence. The idea is that you sneak up on your opponent and he does not know that you're there. And there was controversial enough, but I'm sure that the idea that you would do that to defining what is a military target broadly, something that would not be a warship, was there indeed a lot of debate, even within Germany, was there debate about whether that was the right thing to do?
Well, yes, in the first place, it never had occurred to anybody to do this until it happened, as far as I was ever able to find out. And certainly there was discussion of it, because all the rules for warfare on the sea had been written before the submarine had any possibility of doing anything. So that they dated back to the middle of the 19th century. And then, of course, there were traditional principles long before that. So that the idea was that when, let's say, you were a surface vessel and you intercepted a tanker or a freighter, you would let the crew get off, and the rules required that you see them to a place of safety, and then you could sink this vessel or do whatever you wanted to do with it. And the submarine, of course, couldn't risk that for several reasons. A surface vessel could ram it, and then when the British armed them with deck guns, and one shot from one of those could, of course, sink a submarine. So that it became apparent that if you were going to do this, use submarines in this fashion, you would probably have to do it without warning. And this term came to be called unrestricted submarine warfare. You would do it without any such restrictions. And this was regarded as the height of barbarism in many parts of the world, indeed, and certainly in the United States. And, of course, it was ultimately this use of the submarine by the Germans that got the United States, pushed the U.S. into the war in 1917.
Yeah, that's the great irony here. Obviously, the Germans no doubt felt that they were forced into doing this because of the British blockade, but then the decision to have this unrestricted submarine warfare, and indeed, as you say, this was the thing that ultimately persuaded the United States to enter the war, and then ultimately it meant the German defeat.
Yes, that's exactly right. The submarine inadvertently, from the German point of view, brought about the defeat of the Germans, I think, more than any other single factor. Who knows quite what would have happened. And the odd thing about it was, too, that after having decided to adopt this strategy at the end of 1916, the Germans did not proceed to build a much larger submarine fleet to carry it out.
That, I guess that is indeed one of the other sort of fascinating questions about why it is that they decided, given the fact that it decided to go in this direction and the fact that from their point of view it might have seemed to be initially to be successful, why they didn't build more boats and go into it even bigger than they did.
One would think they did. They had not started the war with the great supply, and they never really, in a sense, had the number of submarines that would ensure the success of such a campaign. One reason for that in 1917 was that the army, whose leaders were then, in fact, de facto dictators of Germany, wouldn't simply give them the manpower they needed to turn out the submarines. And the other thing was, I think, that all during the war, the Germans tended to overestimate their capacities. They had the same problem as we know in the Second World War. But they did then, and they thought that, apparently, with the number of vessels they had, they could come close, at least, and perhaps, I guess they thought, ultimately, defeat the British before the United States could become an effective factor.
Once we get into World War II, I wonder what other than size, then the vessels got bigger. At least the United States was building bigger submarines. And you can, if you go, for example, up to Chicago to the Museum of Science and Industry, you can actually go inside a U-boat, the 505 that was that was captured, and you can get a feel for it. And it's really small. It's not a big craft at all. Yeah. So one of the things that I think that, that the United States did when it was building some of the submarines that it used in World War II is at least these boats were a little bit bigger. What were some of the technological advancements in the submarines once we get into World War II?
Well, they had better power plants, of course. They had air conditioning, which was important not only for comfort, but as a means of preserving the electrical systems from corrosion. They had sonar, which was very significant. And, of course, operating on the surface, they had radar. So, and in general, the level of what the submarine people call habitability, I mean, how easy it is to live on, was considerably better in the Second War from the First War, but not anything that most people would like very long anyway. So that it was really, I think you might say, incremental. I don't think you would say a great revolutionary change, except perhaps for radar and sonar, from the First War. They were pretty dinky boats in the First War. They were pretty smelly and so forth, and they were pretty smelly in World War II. The Germans used to talk about how they had a special soap that was supposed to work well in seawater, but did not. And they would take one of the two latrines they had and fill it with supplies so that everybody had to use one latrine and so forth. Mm-hmm. So they were pretty gamey affairs in both wars. But technically, the difference, I think, aside from what I mentioned, I don't think there's any other really major difference.
What size crews are we talking about?
Well, they might vary, let's say, 55 or 60, something of that sort, generally. And what we call a fleet boat, the basic boat that served the United States through the war. Mm-hmm. And the Germans tend to have slightly smaller crews, I would say.
For in terms of its military significance in World War II, how was the role different, or was the role different from that of World War I?
Well, at two really separate wars, the Atlantic and Pacific. In the Atlantic, the Germans ended up trying exactly what they had ended up deciding to do in the First War, namely to isolate Britain by means of submarines. After all, when all was said and done, that became, again, the method of choice. And the United States, again, was supplying the British. And there was the famous Battle of the Atlantic. The Battle of the Atlantic went heavily against Britain in 1917, and it seemed for a time as if the Germans might win, even with their relatively small number of boats. The same thing was happening severely in the Atlantic into the summer of 1943. Now, what was a big technical difference by then was other types of submarine detection, methods of improved depth charging methods, and, of course, intelligence. There was a huge intelligence battle going on in the Second War between the Germans and the British, with the advantage shifting back and forth. And in the Pacific, the United States played the role the Germans played in the Atlantic, in this case, the United States versus the Japanese merchant fleet, but trying to do exactly the same thing. Hmm. Keep supplies from Southeast Asia and the Netherlands East Indies from reaching Japan.
We talked about how that role was maybe at least at some point in World War I controversial. By the time we get around to World War II, was anybody saying had any problem with that, or by that time was that idea that would be an appropriate use of the submarine, and so that no one said, gee, is this really the right thing for us to be doing?
An excellent question. The United States, of course, had entered the First World War protesting against the German methods, let's say. There are many other factors, of course, but that was prominent among President Wilson's charges. The United States also, and other countries, had agreed during the interwar period, before 1939, that they would not revert to this unrestricted submarine warfare. Pearl Harbor came along, and that happened, of course, at 8:05 Hawaii time on the morning of December the 7th. And by 3:00 that afternoon, Pearl Harbor had received a message from the chief of naval operations in the war in Washington telling them to execute unrestricted warfare. So that objection lasted only a few hours. And there seemed to be no question about it. You're absolutely right. No question. And, of course, the definition of many of these things had changed during those years and rapidly changed in the Second War, just as years before that bombing of civilians was considered abhorrent. But, as we know, during the Second World War, it became perfectly common practice, and the term home front came along, and everybody, any country, was viewed as part of the war effort, no matter what he or she did or did not. And the submarine, the change in the view of the submarine's activities was just part of this overall cultural shift, I think.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Thomas Parrish. He's written a number of books on 20th century history, including this recently published book that we've been talking about, which is a history of the development of the submarine and its use in war, and it's published by Viking, and the title is The Submarine, A History. And we have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. We have a caller in Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. My question is about how nuclear energy in a modern submarine is converted into the energy that makes the submarine move. I assume that the nuclear plant heats up water, does it, makes steam? Is that in?
It boils water.
Yeah. And is it a reciprocating steam engine or a steam turbine?
It's a turbine.
It's a turbine. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
That's what I understand. Or turbines, really, more than one, I think.
Well, this here gets us into the more modern era of the submarine. And again, as we talked a little bit about earlier, previous submarines, as sophisticated as they were, really spent most of their time on the surface. And
yes,
the amount of time that you could spend submerged was limited because there you were running off of batteries, and that was good for only so long. Mm-hmm. But here, when we come to the nuclear submarine in the early 1950s, we truly have a vessel that is capable of staying under the water for a very long period of time. And that, again, makes the role of the submarine, its strategic significance, much different than it had been before.
Let me comment on that. The nuclear submarine by itself was an amazing development, yes, and remarkable. And it was the first really true submarine in that its real home was under the water and not on the surface.
Mm-hmm.
But by itself, it would not, as far as I know, have changed the strategic situation in the world. What did change the situation was the combining of the submarine with the ballistic missile. And this was a great program carried out in the United States under Admiral Rayburn when they developed the Polaris missile, the first one of these to be fitted into a submarine. Now, this was considered very difficult and impossible by many people. It's a wonderful story, which I tell and I certainly found fascinating. So that it was the blend of these things, the platform being the almost invulnerable nuclear sub, and then the Polaris missile, which could be fired from under the water. And as people may know, in the 1950s, there was much discussion of the vulnerability of cities, of defenses. What role would bombers play? What role would ICBMs play? And so forth and so on. And here you had this defense system developed that guaranteed a response to any strike on the United States. This actually, I think, completely revolutionized the strategic situation in the world, and the world of commerce raiding submarines then became a thing of the past. This became the role of the submarine in a strange way, guaranteeing the peace by being an invulnerable protector and retaliator. And it was the combination of these two things. The nuclear sub made it possible, but by itself it would have been a wonderful development, but not had the impact that it gained because of the development of the missile that could be fired not only from a ship, but from a submarine, and not only from a submarine, but underwater.
Yeah. Yeah, at the time people would talk about strategic nuclear program that we had here resting on these three legs. It was always talked of as a triad. You have land-based, sea-based, and air-based weapons. But I think you're making the argument, other people probably make the argument, that of those three legs, maybe the most significant in maintaining this balance and keeping us from going to war was indeed the submarine, because
Oh, yes.
It was this very powerful platform for launching ballistic you know, intercontinental ballistic nuclear weapons, and because it could stay submerged for such a long period of time, it could be anywhere. So the issue of trying to for your opponent to figure out where your submarines were was an extremely difficult challenge, and made the idea of launching an attack really problematic because of how you accounted for where that third leg was.
Yes, it was really transformative. The more I thought about this, the more I realized how revolutionary that was, and I think maybe it's not very generally realized that from the 1960s on, the world became very different because of this development. It's just really extraordinary, and certainly the submarine was, I think, far more important. You know, they used to talk about hardening missile sites and all of those things, but this was completely different. You might say that an enemy could catch a nuclear sub after it had launched the missiles, if it had come to that, but that would be too late, and therefore the enemy would realize the barn door would be flapping wide open and the horse would be gone. Mm.
We have some other callers here. Well, we'll talk next with someone in Des Plaines on our line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Mm-hmm.
I'd just like to ask a question concerning World War One. Would it be fair to say that if the British had not armed the merchant vessels, that the submarines would be continue their practice of surfacing, letting the crews off, and then sinking the unmanned ship so that the lives would be saved, but only the cargo would be lost?
I think that is really an excellent point, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I've often pondered that myself. The interesting thing is that just right at the beginning of the war, perhaps even before it, in the House of Commons, Churchill, as First Lord of the Admiralty, made a statement about the arming of merchant vessels. Well, this, of course, everybody knew. I don't remember the date of it exactly, but this was something to make any sub-skipper think twice. I think you could make a very interesting case for that. Now, probably it wouldn't have worked out that way in the long run, but it might have initially, because they also had to worry about ramming, which used to be a very popular tactic. You don't hear much about it nowadays. But the British vessels were also instructed, where possible, to ram a sub, because if the sub had stopped and was then, say, giving commands to the stopped merchant vessel, the merchant vessel could turn on it and accelerate enough, would not take much of a blow to send the submarine to the bottom. There were other factors as well. But I think that is a point well worth discussion, yes.
Okay, well, thank you. You've answered my question.
All right, well, thanks for the call. We'll go back here to a caller in Champaign. This would be line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I wondered if you could say something about the use of depth chargers and what they're made of and how they're deployed, and if there's been any sort of documented experience of survivors of a depth charger attack, what that was like for people in the submarines, although it seems obvious, but I'm just curious about how those worked. And
Okay.
I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay, sorry. Depth charges it is, yes. Yes, there was one fellow who reported that the sound of a depth charge as if you were inside a bucket and had somebody beating on it as hard as he could. So practically addling, it was so upsetting. And one veteran I talked with said that he had asked the old chief of the boat, the old chief non-commissioned officer, when a depth charge first, they heard one on his boat, he said, you know, he, so to speak, had not bargained for this. He thought, you know, what do we do about that? And the fellow said, you get used to it. They were just simply, they were called ash cans from the First World War days, and originally they were just rolled off the decks of destroyers, primarily. Then they developed later methods that would launch them high in the air, get them even farther away from the launching vessel, and they had methods that would not only drop them astern, as was originally the idea, but also they were called ahead throwing. A hedgehog was one of them. They would throw them in advance so that you could protect your, attack the submarine wherever it was. You didn't have to wait to get ahead of it, in other words, to attack it. So there were various sophistications of this, but essentially they were just like bombs that were dropped and set to detonate at a particular weight. Now, a curious thing happened sometimes when a ship carrying depth charges would be preset. If this ship itself was torpedoed and sank or was in trouble, if it got very far down, the depth charges themselves would explode, thus ending any chance of people escaping who were happened to be still on it. So essentially, they were just rather direct methods of sending a load of explosives at an enemy vessel, and these attacks could be very harrowing. They would, of course, tend to weaken the hull a bit. The insulation of the vessel would come. You've probably seen, again, World War II movies in particular, or World War I movies with water coming in and so forth, and you simply had to wait and be very, very quiet.
Just how, because this was a matter of, I'm not exactly sure that it's appropriate to say guesswork, but essentially the ship on the surface had to determine where the submarine was and mm-hmm. then drop these things and time them and position them in a way so that they would at least get close. That would be the idea. You'd get as close as possible to the submarine before yes. it would explode, which seemed to be, you know, pretty a difficult challenge. Just how effective wow. were they in taking out submarines?
Well, depth charges destroyed a number of submarines. I don't give you a figure offhand, but they were reasonably successful. But the submarine's tactic was, of course, to be absolutely quiet. So the commanding officer had to try to figure out where it might be, as you say, and this sometimes worked and sometimes didn't. And also, submarines, some would carry a kit of parts so that they could release it, and it would look like debris from the ship, as if it had been hit when it hadn't, or at least not crippled. Mm-hmm. But the best thing about this method was it was the only thing that was available, so that was what was used.
We'll try to get at least one more caller. Bloomington, Indiana, line number two. Hello?
Good morning. Mm-hmm. David, since you had mentioned the U-505 over at the museum in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
I thought some listeners might be interested in a fuller accounting, and there's a Rear Admiral Daniel Gallery who wrote the book 20 Million Tons Under the Sea. I suspect that your guest is familiar with the book. But the other reason I called is, could you please tell us, there's two submarine movies. One is Das Boot. I wonder if that is a realistic portrayal. And then secondly, on The Hunt for Red October, there's an aspect where the submarines are traversing through the Laurentian trenches in the North Atlantic. Was that particularly realistic? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
I don't know. I read the Red October many years ago now. The Red October was published by the Naval Institute originally, you know, oddly enough. I think their first work of fiction to publish, which suggests to me that they believed that it had a reasonable level of authenticity. It squares pretty well with other accounts from people who were nonfiction accounts as well. So I think pretty much, and some of it I think is brilliant speculation too. I mean, after all, Tom Clancy was in the insurance business originally. The other question was about Das Boot, and Das Boot is very highly spoken of by everybody I've talked with or who has seen the movie. It is considered a really first-class depiction of U-boat life.
It gives you an appreciation for it. You want to talk about claustrophobia.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
For what it would have been like living in those close quarters like that.
Yes.
Well, we've come to the end of the show, and I just want to say, Mr. Parrish, thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you. I enjoyed it, and I must congratulate you. You obviously read the book.
Well, we give it the best try that we can. For other folks who are interested in learning more about the history of the submarine, you can look for the book, and it is indeed titled The Submarine, A History. It's published by Viking by our guest, Thomas Parrish. You've been listening to a Focus 580 program we first broadcast earlier this year. If you'd like to hear some show that you might have missed, or listen to past interviews from the Afternoon Magazine, or hear some of our other local production, it's all available at our website, will.uiuc.edu. It's there and ready for you anytime that you are ready to listen. I'm David Inge. Thanks very much for being with us today. We hope that you will stay tuned. Coming up shortly, the Afternoon Magazine.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
You're tuned to AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 2 minutes before noon. I'm Celeste Quinn, 79 degrees in Urbana. Our technical director at this point is Jason Croft. And coming up, we'll have the afternoon magazine for you in the 1 o'clock hour today. I'll welcome your telephone calls for Carol Lindholm and Jim Keel of the Dog Training Club of Champaign-Urbana. They'll take your questions about dog care, behavior, and training following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. September wheat, 306 and three quarters, down 4.5. December, 318, down 4.5. September corn, 223.5, down 4.25. December corn, 231.25, down 5. March, 239.5, down 5. December 05,